Right, just to introduce the session. In early January, the House of Lords International Relations Committee published a report on the UK and the future of the Western Balkans. In July, the United Kingdom will host the annual summit of the Berlin Process here in London. So, congratulations to Global Strategy Forum on this very topical and timely event. In one way, perhaps, it's just a little too topical, because today sees the second reading in the House of Lords of the EU withdrawal bill, and this deprives us of one of the speakers, Baroness Smith, but miraculously, our other two speakers are here with us today. Both are extremely well known to the Global Strategy Forum, so introductions can be exceptionally brief. We have Lord Howell, who is the chair of the International Relations Committee, and I believe the only minister to have served in Heath, Thatcher and Cameron administrations, and we're very lucky to have him today. He will speak first on the report. And then we have Lord Hannay, a member of the International Relations Committee, and one of the UK's absolutely preeminent So we're very fortunate. Well, you'd like to take us away.
Well, Chairman, thank you very much indeed, and I join with others in sending good wishes to Michael Lothian, who has been such an inspiration to this organisation, for his rapid recovery. As you've heard, we over at the House of Lords, those of us who are all here, are in the middle of a ginormous debate with practically, I think, 190 speakers. So I just want to make sure I'm going to give you the right speech and not the one I was going to give you about Henry VIII's powers, Bonaparte powers, statutory instruments and all the rest that the lawyers get so excited about. The International Relations Committee is quite a new one, and we are trying to focus both in the longer term, away, if possible, from the Brexit issue, although of course it flows into everything, and to look at the wider world, which has changed so radically in the last few years and is changing even faster now. So our survey doesn't obviously exclude Europe, because we're going to discuss an important aspect of Europe, but it goes far beyond the immediate issues of the European Union. I've just reminded, Chairman, your introduction about serving in three administrations. I was explaining this at a speech in Australia, and the chap came on and said, "You're having a bit of a job holding down your job, aren't you?" They put me in my place. And the answer is, one goes in and out of government over the years, picks up some ideas, abandons others, and so on. Now, the International Relations Committee had been looking at the Middle East. We are now looking at a much bigger range of issues concerned with what happens to British diplomacy and foreign policy interface in the digital age of totally transformed and redistributed patterns of power in the world. And it's going to be a very big study, a very important one, because the world's moving very fast. But in between, we also thought we should focus on this subject. I think it's going too far to say it's a forgotten area of Europe. It certainly isn't forgotten. And as far as it's ever been forgotten, we've all played a terrible price for neglect. But anyway, it didn't come into and doesn't come into the major Brexit debates of the moment. Nevertheless, it is something where the price of inattention in the past has been very high, and we felt that we should return to it, remembering the horrors of 20 years ago, and praying that we would find that they're not going to be repeated and that there was progress being made. What were our conclusions? Not terribly optimistic about the underlying tensions and differences and dislikes and differentiations which dominate the whole region still, as they did 20 years ago. I think some hope that this would not blow up again into the kind of horror and violence that we all remember so vividly and in which the UK was enormously involved. We sense that we should remain involved, we should remain engaged. In fact, we're reflecting a view that seems to be held in official circles as well, that and is expressed in the fact that there's going to be a major summit, West Balkan summit, here in the UK later this year, as part of the continuing Berlin process. So that satisfies the straightforward point, you know, why is Britain interested in this? Why are British parliamentarians interested in this? The answer is because we have been engaged, and we indeed concluded that we needed very much to be engaged in the future. A slight conundrum, which one or two people pointed out, part sympathy and amusement, they said, how come that you British are planning to go separate ways from the European Union and move out from all the great treaties, while at the same time you're telling us in the West Balkans that one of the pathways forward, which is a positive one, which we work for, is joining the European Union. That requires a little explaining which way you're going. We do have an answer to that, a perfectly sensible answer. Britain remains a great European power. We remain involved, in fact, some would argue, and I'd be one of them, that we're moving towards new forms of engagement and relationship with the European Union and the continent of Europe, which, if anything, in some areas, are going to be more intense than they were before the Brexit process began. And it may be that here, this is an area where we need to devise new forms of engagement and cooperation with our European partners to carry things forward. So we didn't have too many hesitations on that point. Certainly there is the question of the changing European scene. One gets a much stronger sense of that in East and Central Europe since our visits down there. I have visited other parts of East and Central Europe, and there are a lot of new ideas about how Europe should be organised going around, some of them being expressed rather vividly and controversially, as you know, in Warsaw, let alone in Budapest or in Prague or in Bratislava. So Europe is changing anyway, and the Europe that the West Balkans are aspiring to move towards and join may be a slightly different thing from the one we have today or we had yesterday. Thirdly, the EU isn't the only path. There's a question of a membership of NATO, which of course Croatia already has and Montenegro already has. The British ambassador in Sarajevo, the excellent Edward Ferguson, the most impressive man, told us that whenever he meets the Russian ambassador, the Russian ambassador says slightly mournfully, well, my job's to stop you joining NATO, and there'll be all hell to pay if you go ahead on that, Bosnia goes ahead on that route. So NATO is a pathway. And NATO, you know, it's slightly less enthusiastically embraced in Belgrade, but nevertheless, as we know, Serbian military forces do cooperate on exercises with NATO troops. And I think, you know, the hang-up is more in the mind than in the practice. NATO is a pathway forward as well as the EU. So and of course Britain is a major player in NATO, one of the biggest, and there we do have influence, and there's no reason why we shouldn't use it favourably to make this pathway work as is appropriate and with the proper conditions. So that would be our answer to the conundrum, but it was raised, I have to say that. It would be silly to say it wasn't. What are our recommendations? Well, a list of hopes and ambitions. We've got to do more on doing support the domestic priorities for the region. We were appalled, I think, by the continued degree of segregation in teaching and school children. It reminded me, I spent a long time in Northern Ireland, and it seemed to me I heard the same language being repeated down the years of unacceptable, intolerable, all these angry words, which filled us with some foreboding. But perhaps these things can be overcome through time. There was the problem of state capture and restrictions on freedom of expression, especially the Serbian press is really under a sort of government control, not direct, but very evident. There are all the problems that are ours as well as the region's of handling migration, drug trafficking, and all the rest that we're so familiar with and fill the daily pages. What can we do at the end of all that? I think reinforce our determination to support civil society, to support judicial reform, to support military The military training reform program is a very interesting one, and is all part of the need to bring these tents and into hostile communities together. So we came back saying we must work on. We think that never again must the neglect lead to the kind of atrocities and horrors of the wars 22 years ago. We think that Britain has a continued important role, and we intend to engage in it, and we use the West Balkan summit as an opportunity for going forward in a number of key areas. So I think that's enough from me to say that this was an expedition for the International Relations Committee that came back with a surprising feeling that we had a role to play, that we had some contribution to give, and that there is more work to be done. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Well, I will supplement and compliment my chairman, Lord Howell, who has introduced this report to you. I think that when we were set out to do it, we were aware that we were treading a fairly fine line between sounding too alarmist and being said to be anticipating some reversion to the 1990s by the middle of next week, which is not what we found, or sounding too complacent. That's to say that boys will be boys, the Balkans will be the Balkans, and this will just go on. So we were treading a fine line between those two extremes, and I hope we found the right balance in that. And I do think we were struck when we looked at the history. Of course, history doesn't repeat itself precisely, but three times in the 20th century, wars have broken out in the Balkans, and on every single one of those occasions, Britain, which had been extraordinarily complacent and absent at the time the fighting broke out, ended up spending rather a lot of blood and treasure trying to sort things out. Now, as I say, history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but that doesn't mean to say this sort of thing could happen somewhere down the line if the friends of the countries of the Western Balkans don't help them to avoid that. So I think that was one big theme that came through, but it was a fine line we had to tread. Then this question of how do we relate to the European Union when we ourselves will have left it, and which will, after all, be a hugely important player in the Balkans, both for reasons of propinquity, resources, etc. And I think to us, it seemed to us, I'm not a great fan of many of the government's slogans about Brexit, but I do think that the one that they coined saying, which the Prime Minister has used quite often, saying we are leaving the European Union, but we are not leaving Europe. That's quite an intelligent formulation, but it's only a useful formulation if you actually do something about it. It's no good just saying that endlessly and expecting that everyone will smile sweetly and say, that's wonderful, thank you very much. We've got to do something about it, and that's where the focus on the July Balkan Summit, West Balkan Summit in London, seemed to us to provide a really major opportunity for the government to set out what Britain, outside the European Union, will be prepared to put into this effort over, let's say, the next 5 years, in terms of resources, in terms of military training, in terms of supporting the rule of law, the freedom of the press, a democracy, and so on. I hope that the government will accept that advice. It's only advice. But if they think that the Balkan summit is a wonderful photo op, then I think they're wrong. These photo ops are ephemeral in the extreme. But if it actually leads to a setting out of what Britain will do in the future in partnership with the European Union, and this is quite clearly the Balkans, an area where that new partnership really has to be turned into reality if it's to be not another meaningless slogan. And that means, for example, that we will have to resist the temptation, which will undoubtedly be offered to us, of being played off against the European Union. I think I know enough about the peoples of the Western Balkans and certainly of the Eastern Mediterranean to know that that is a sport at which they excel. And so if we are to have a good effect in the Balkans, I think we have to understand that it can only be done if we work in partnership with the European Union, which has a lot of reasons to persevere also there. So that was, I think, pretty... those were one or two rather important findings. And when you look at that cooperation with the EU, it's not only about resources for programs to help the countries of the Western Balkans strengthen their societies and their politics. It's also about really quite down-to-earth matters like cooperation over fighting crime. An awful lot of the crime in this country is perpetrated by nationals of countries in the Eastern Balkans and Western Balkans. And we and the European Union share exactly the same interests on that. And we're going to have to find a way of cooperating on that too. I think we did come to the conclusion that although democracy and freedom of the press were extremely important and there should be no backing off from that, the weaknesses in the rule of law institutions were very, very obvious in most of the Balkan countries. And so we thought that if there was one area where the UK could put quite a lot of emphasis, it should be on the rule of law. Another area, it seemed to us, which was not being properly utilised, was higher education. Of course, there are universities in the Western Balkans, but the really clever students there are almost invariably going to want to come to do their master's degrees or their doctorates or their higher technical training and so on to Western Europe, including the UK. And we sure don't make it easy for them. So we believe, as we've said on a number of other occasions in our report on the Middle East as well, that the government really must stop treating students as economic migrants and must open the doors of our universities to these students, must put more money into things like the Chevening scholarships, because we held a round table with quite a lot of Chevening scholars from all these countries and we spent a fascinating morning with them. And at the end of that, we had no doubt whatsoever that Britain was developing a source of soft power, but was also contributing really helpfully to enabling a new generation to come forward in these countries whose views will be a bit different from the old generations. Trade and investment, we noticed, was absolutely minimal British involvement there, and we were a bit astonished to find that the Department of International Trade didn't seem to have noticed that on the 29th of March 2019, we would cease to be in a free trade area with the Western Balkans and might have to apply World Trade Organization tariffs to their exports and have them apply the same to ours. That would be absolutely absurd. But they've only got 14 months to get that sorted out, and they sure hadn't started by the time we took evidence from them. So that was another area which we looked a bit about the Russian role, and it's obviously quite prominent, particularly the attempted interference in Montenegro at the time it was moving towards joining NATO, which is now done, which is a very good thing. I think we were struck by the fact that the Russians in the Western Balkans are really now just spoilers, as the chairman suggested when he gave that quotation from Sarajevo. And I think it is clear that they don't have a viable alternative to offer these countries, which would be better than eventual membership of the European Union, better than NATO membership, better than democracy and the rule of law. So they are really spoilers. That means, obviously, that we have to try and help these countries resist that sort of, those sort of activities. But I think it's not a cause of imminent panic necessary, because I don't think the Russian offer is actually very attractive. Final point I'd make about migration. It's odd how short people's memories are. But when people talk about migration, I think most of them are at the moment talking about large numbers of Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis, and so on, transiting the Balkans, the Western Balkans, into the rest of Europe. That, of course, was a huge problem a year or two ago, and it could be a huge problem again. But the biggest migration crisis before this one we went through from Syria and the Middle East was, of course, the crisis of the 1990s, when vast numbers of inhabitants of the Western Balkans, for perfectly legitimate reasons, because they were in fear of their lives, and they were being in fear of starvation, every kind of horror was being heaped upon them, and they got up and they moved. And many of them you will find across Western Europe, probably making a major contribution to our economies now. But it is a reminder that when you talk about migration in the Western Balkans, it's not only in terms of a transit route, it is also in terms of a possible source of migration if the rule of law and all the other things that hold societies together were to break down or were to crumble. So I think there are quite a lot of material in there to justify the idea that Britain, outside the European Union, but in Europe — there are some benefits of having a Prime Minister with a geography degree, because some of her colleagues don't even seem to understand that. But nevertheless, in Europe, why we should play a major role in this future, and why that role should be a role which we should play in partnership with the members of the European Union. So I think that's enough, and I'm sure questions will take us into a lot of other interesting areas.
David, thank you very much. Right, it's question time. Yes, indicate that you want to raise a question by raising your hands. Then Jacqueline will come round on twinkling feet with a microphone. And the first thing you can do, perhaps, in asking the question would be to identify yourself. First row.
John Wilson, I'm a member of this organisation, journalist and a member of a number of think tanks. The famous British Foreign Secretary in the 19th century remarked that there would always be and always was trouble in the Balkans. As Bill Deeds would say, it was ever thus. I put it to you that you're being too optimistic in your outlook, and that in fact we're going to have years of trouble in future.
Well, I think that was the same questions we put to ourselves. I don't think we were optimistic. I don't think our conclusions are all that optimistic. I do think things have changed, but then the whole global scene has changed. It's very hard to make judgments just about one small region, the West Balkans or Southeast Europe or whatever, separate from the context of what the Russians are up to, the Americans are up to, the Chinese are up to, the Turks are up to, and the Arab world is up to, all of whom have dabbled in and are continuing to dabble in the area. So I don't think we... on the one hand, one doesn't see it just as the full horrors of bursting out at the end of Yugoslavia, which caused all the ethnic cleansing and so on 22 years ago and paralysed Europe for a time. On the one hand, we don't see that. But on the other hand, there's no illusions. We have no scales on our eyes about the involvement of all these various or non-involvement various powers. We asked about America. I mean, Trump, when he was campaigning, indicated he didn't want America involved in any foreign ventures of any kind and so on. So that was personally a question on my mind, how much are the Americans still here? In practice, the State Department officials and local American officials are still fully engaged. So, in a sense, there's two Americas, there's the White House America and the State Department America. So that is, America is still there, but not obviously with the commitment of Dayton and Holmes and all those people. The Russian side that David Hand has just commented on, it was more sort of vague and amorphous, not much money behind it, but a general feeling that trouble was around and that the Russians had plenty of news stories to warn people against getting too involved in the wicked West and so on. The Chinese are there with money as usual, putting it behind great motorway and railway projects. The Turks are building, putting money into mosque building in Sarajevo. And someone asks, well, you know, what is Turkey today? Are they on, got some new agenda? Are they moving out of the Western influence altogether? Are they about to say goodbye to NATO? And quite what game they're playing, not clear. And of course, there is considerable Arab money and Arab involvement as well. So I think all this led us to feel that the situation has changed. Not necessarily totally for the better, but has changed. And we have to understand there are new forces and modalities at work, and this is a digital age. Everyone is connected to everyone. Everyone has a mobile telephone, and an iPad, and so on. The connectivity is total, just down there as it is here. It's a different world of 20 years ago, and we think that just maybe, well, there are many other problems. The return to the unbelievable atrocities of Srebrenica and so on is not at the top of the likelihoods.
That would be
my answer. I don't know whether David would have to.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Into
second row.
Patricia Rawlings has asked, if I could ask Lord Hannay a question. You mentioned about the importance of the rule of law, chief scholars, soft power. I wonder what your view is about a basic British association of Central and Eastern Europe that used to be such a good Foreign Office body that did exchange programmes for local government lawyers, and then it was disbanded once the major changes in Europe. And I wondered whether there might be a role for something like that with our involvement.
Well, there could be. I mean, our main principle was that the government should take the opportunity of the Western Balkans Summit this summer to set out a serious program of supporting democracy, the rule of law, etc., freedom of speech, for, let's say, 5 years. It's not inconceivable that what you're speaking about could be part of that. But, of course, the Western, I'm trying to remember what the Institute of Democracy is called, but which applies to the whole world, which does exist and which is doing work in the Balkans. And I'm not sure that there might not be some duplication there if you just produced a purely regional one. But I don't know enough about it to give you a clear answer.
Don?
Donald Anderson, House of Lords. Bosnia appears to be the country with the least progress, indeed with some backsliding. Post-statement, there appears to be a paralysis for the bloated bureaucracy, Russia leaning on Dodik in Republika Srpska. Given the vested interests against any form of change in Bosnia, how can one possibly make a breakthrough?
Well, what to answer negatively, what hasn't changed, of course, is the constitution that ended the war, the Dayton one, is not an ideal constitution for bringing about the peace. And, of course, there's the Republika Srpska, there's the Croatian influence, Bosnia-Croatia, the Bosniak views, the separation I've already mentioned in schools, the funny arrangement of the two parliaments, Federation Parliament and the other one. And, so all of this is sort of frozen in time. We did raise the question of, well, what about new constitutions? But people there said, as I recall, well, let's leave constitutions until we've got a better underlying feeling that things are working together, and then we can get involved in constitutions later. But now, afraid that it's a story that is on the constitutional side rather frozen. The enmities are still there. The words, as I said earlier, are intolerable and unacceptable, were reflected in some of the groups and pals we met from various parts of Bosnia Herzegovina. And I don't think I can say anything very, very positive, except that, as I said in an earlier answer, the world has changed, conditions have changed, attitudes have changed, behaviour has changed, and maybe out of that some of the horrific hostilities and dislikes and hatreds will ease a bit. Part of this, I can say.
Yeah, I think one of the things we were very conscious of was that one should see the whole of the Western world through the prism of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is, as the question suggests, and as Howard says, in a very unsatisfactory kind of limbo between where violence has ceased, but the subsequent arrangements are not working properly. But actually, if you look at Kosovo and the problems there, where after all, after we produced our report, there was an extremely horrible murder there of a Serb activist. If you look at Macedonia, where things looked as if they were heading badly off the rails quite recently until the elections last year, which brought to office a government which is trying to get back onto a course which gives the Albanian, ethnic Albanians in Macedonia, a proper place in Macedonian society. So there are no lack of these, and it isn't wise, I think, to use the Bosnia prism in that way. First of all, because it makes you far too depressed and pessimistic. But secondly, because it means you neglect some other quite risky areas which need a lot of work.
Thank you. There was a question there.
Thank you very much. Ewan Grant, I'm a former customs and excise intelligence analyst for Southeastern and Eastern Europe, and I did work 3 years in the EU Customs and Tax Assistance Mission in Bosnia. My question is partly based on experiences there, because that was at the time, almost entirely the same time when Mr. Paddy Ashdown was High Representative, and I noticed that on my frequent returns, he is still fondly remembered, much more so than some of the other High Representatives. And my question is this: when Britain, assuming Britain does leave the EU, and I know you've said that it's not a complete break, we're still working together, is the European Commission or the member states working together, but particularly the Commission, up to the job of holistic, constructive, flexible dialogue with the entire region? Because from my personal experience, I found that the British punched heavily above their weight because they were much more pragmatic, and much of the Brussels effort was excessively legalistic, sometimes literally so, and didn't really translate well into the situation on the ground. Thank you.
Paddy Ashdown came forward to the committee and gave some very strong evidence, of course he has remained very much watching it and being a voice of warning, having made a big impression when he was there. Just a small point, I think in front of our committee he gave evidence saying he regarded BIH as a failed state, which was a word that I think many people didn't like down in Sarajevo, rather understandably. I think that was possibly the wrong word. Fragile, yes, fractured, clearly still, but failed, no, because there is momentum towards becoming a state and overcoming the problems, however slow. So, yes, as to the EU input, I think I'll leave that. We talked with EU officials and so on, although one of the senior EU officials had a flu, so we just didn't see him on our visit. But my impression was that there was somewhat, not despair, some reserve about the progress that the EU was making, and a feeling that things may have been slipping away, and the feeling that locally enthusiasm for the EU was not as strong as it was. And maybe we have to admit that maybe our example with Brexit has not helped. One has to be realistic, maybe.
Yes, I think you have to remember about the EU that it's only been in the peacemaking and peacekeeping business for a very short time now. And you need rather a lot of time to build up the sort of experience that's necessary, the cadre of officials who can be really effective in places like that. So I would guess that they will get better at it as time goes along. They're not going to give up on it. This is right on their doorstep. And they're not going to give up trying to help the Balkans become more democratic and so on. So I would think that the fact that we are leaving is not their fault. It's our fault. So it's no good then saying they're not very good at peacekeeping because we aren't going to be there to teach them pragmatism. Perhaps we could have thought of that 18 months ago. But we didn't. I think the necessity for the European Union to play a major role in the Balkans is absolute. There's no one else that is so closely involved, and so much is it on their doorstep. Now, one thing that's not being sort of talked about much, but which should be quite benign, is that the European Union economy, the Eurozone in particular, is now growing quite rapidly, and much more rapidly than it has done since 2008. This will have, on the whole, very benign consequences for the countries of the Western Balkans, because their economies are crucially linked to the continental European economies in particular, and Germany above all. Well, Germany is growing between 2 and 3% now, and by the time they have a coalition, it probably will unleash higher public spending, they could be growing faster. That will be beneficial, and it will be an important influence, benign influence, in the Western Balkans.
Thank you. There's a question over there who already has a microphone.
Thank you, Chairman. John Sandwich from House of Lords, a crossbencher. I've been interested in the Western Balkans because I have a son-in-law from Kosovo. I was there a year ago, and I wanted to ask David Hanney, the spirit of Martti Ahtisaari reigned at one time, probably 9 or 10 years ago, the UN envoy at the time, and he had tremendous ambitions. Is his name remembered at all? And what about ULEX, which after all, you've started the theme of the rule of law, which is absolutely significant, and we must follow it up with the EU somehow. But how are we going to replace
ULEX,
and was it a failure of the EU?
Well, I don't know about Ahtisaari. I knew Martti very well from my time at the United Nations. He was a wonderful man with a fantastic track record of dealing with difficult problems, not only in Kosovo, but also in Aceh and of course in Namibia, where he was the UN Special Representative who oversaw transition to independence in Namibia. And so he's a great man, like all of us. He's not any younger, so I'm not quite sure about his availability anymore. He used to have bad knees, but I think he had them operated on. But yes, I mean, it's an indication of how an outside person, Paddy Ashton was another one, can be genuinely helpful to people who are in a very landlocked, confrontational situation like the Serbs and the Albanian ethnic groups are in Kosovo, or like the different groups are in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And personally, I think that there was entirely premature the idea that the high representative job in Sarajevo should be wound down and perhaps abolished. I think that was a very unwise idea. It is now not being pursued, I think. But I'm not sure that the very low profile that is being adopted now is necessarily the best. The trouble about it is that in circumstances like you have in these, both in Kosovo
want to agree with them. But of course, if you agree with one of the parties, you aren't going to get very far, I'm afraid. That was an experience which I had in Cyprus, and you have to avoid that. But then that makes you unpopular. So I think there is a role for an international involvement, and I'm sure there is a role for the ULEX effort, and I think we should be, if our recommendation were followed, and if the government did announce a programme for the next 5 years or so of British involvement in the Western Balkans at the time of the summit in July, then I would hope it would contain some major elements of how we were going to work together with the European Union on areas, not duplicating the European Union, but working in a way which complements the other.
Stanford Henry, Asset Solutions. My question is related to investment, because you discussed this in many ways, but nobody said there's money coming into Bosnia and Herzegovina or other places. In fact, there's very little. I know from the U.S. government's standpoint, they have absolutely no interest in doing anything about creating an enterprise fund or anything like that. The unemployment rate in Bosnia, particularly amongst the young, is very, very high. They're building 120 mosques in Bosnia. There are investments by the Kuwaitis, by Abu Dhabi, vast investments in things like shopping centers and housing. So are you going to address the investment side of this question?
Well, I think addressing the investment side means making it attractive to investors. And investors don't like political uncertainty. They do like skills and talent and motivated young people who I think are a resource of the area. But of course they don't like uncertain political and legal environment at all. They certainly don't like any hint of resumed violence or non-legal methods of operating and manipulation and corruption and so on. So it's a question of how can one change the atmosphere and the image of the area. I think that's the best that can be done. The British government seeks to encourage investors. DFID has not had got a certain role there, but I'm not sure it's very strong, is it, DFID right now? So I think it's a question of conditions. It's all of a circle. If we can support rule of law and a move to stability and a pathway to maybe the EU, would certainly to NATO, if we can support a route whereby the Serbian route is a hang-up with their concern about Kosovo, which is they don't accept it, compared with 121 countries around the world that do. If we can overcome that agonizing block in the road, then I think people will look at the area and say this is, in this age of wanting skill above all, and skill best of all with reasonably low pay rates, that's the ideal, that's the mecca for the modern global investor. More investment will go there, including British investment. But I don't think one can just switch it on like a tap.
No, I'm sure that can't be done that way. But if you look at the history of investment in Central and Eastern Europe, and the way in which once it became absolutely certain that they were on their way into the European Union on a timetable which everyone knew, there was a huge surge of investment into those countries. Not government investment, but private investment, because they knew, as David says, they knew what the timetable was and they knew what the destination was. That will be a very important factor. The Europeans, including ourselves, don't fortunately suffer from a mercantilist approach to investment. So we wouldn't help us very much in the Balkans, because I think persuading the Balkans to invest in our countries would not probably get you very far. So I don't think there will be any inhibition to encouraging investment. But the most important thing is to establish the sort of underpinning of the economies of the Western Balkans and their societies, which make companies in our countries want to invest there. And then, of course, making sure that if they invest there and produce things, they can export them to us free of tariffs and barriers.
It's just worth adding that the Chinese are there. Chinese are everywhere nowadays. And I think they're the main force behind building a motorway from Belgrade down to Tirana. Yeah. So if physical infrastructures help political connectivity, there's one example. May or may not do so. I think we generally underestimate the way in which the new Eurasian order is being put in place by the Chinese, increasingly the Indians, some way the Russians, although they're running behind, and we just have to act in on that. That is a new mindset, I know, which is not very popular, but I think it's tomorrow. Jesse, please.
Thank you very much, Jesse Donashua, former ISDSOC, currently active strategy on Royal Energy's European project, especially the Western Balkan portfolio. And I had a bigger question about framing the debate that we've been having here, that we usually have when we talk about the Western Balkans, which is, I think the destination is clear, and you've said it yourselves many times, that is the European Union. But at a time that the European Union has zero appetite in terms of accepting new members when it's in an internal crisis, be it economic or political, although there still is appetite definitely in the Western Balkans to join the European Union, I wonder whether this is a useful way in terms of framing this discussion, that as if the European Union is the only option on the table. Because when this option starts being controversial, as it is right now, we may get into more trouble than we wanted to. And I wonder whether this is not a good way to start thinking about the British approach to the Western Balkans in terms of, yes, we do have to support the EU reform agendas that have been put on the table for the Western Balkans, but at the same time, there may be other more important areas that we should be engaging with. And let's just not be part of this straitjacket of the European Union reforms. And I think it's really important to think about that. But I'd love to know your opinion about this. And just one side note on higher education, I think it's critical. I think it's even more critical to engage in reforms within the countries rather than these exchanges. But one thing also to think about is that, for example, citizens of Bosnia and Herzegovina have to apply for visas to the United Kingdom. And so when young students want to go on training programs that I would be organizing myself, for example, it would cost a normal family half of their mean monthly salary to actually send one of their children to the United Kingdom because the cost of a visa is £180.
Well, I don't, I'm afraid, recognise your equation of the European Union as a straitjacket. I think that is a piece, if I may say so, of leave propaganda. I've never noticed it as being a straitjacket. What the European Union is trying to do in the accession negotiations is, of course, exactly what we're trying to do, precisely what we are, to get them to respect human rights, freedom of speech, and so on. Now, I think you've perhaps excessively characterised the negative approach of the European Union to further enlargement, because it tends to be expressed in the words of Jean-Claude Juncker, who has expressed himself, in my view, extremely unwisely on a subject for which he is not actually responsible, because enlargement is not a matter for the Commission, it's a matter for the Member States. And I think the things he said about that are deeply unhelpful, but he will be heading to return quite shortly. I do not think that you should assume that the road to further accession is blocked. I think it's a bit clogged sometimes by things like the Greek attitude on the Macedonia, which I have always regarded as aberrant, frankly, and which is contrary, in my view, to Greece's own interests, which must be in the stabilisation of the country that's immediately across their northern border. And I just hope that somehow or other the arrival in Skopje of a new government, which is taking a somewhat more flexible attitude towards, could lead to, first, in order of time priority, Macedonia joining NATO, but then eventually Macedonia joining the European Union. So I think you should not give up on that, frankly, that prospect. The experience of the previous Central and Eastern European countries took an awful long time. It took an awful long time for Spain and Portugal to join the European Union. But was it worth it in terms of the strengthening of their democratic institutions? Yes. Was it worth it in terms of their economy? Yes, because as soon as it became clear they really were going to join, the investment flowed in. So I wouldn't give up on that.
Okay, the question in the middle of towards the back. Yes.
promote lack of knowledge about design of infrastructure. And I notice that you've mentioned in the report state capture and organised crime. I was wondering if perhaps the production of a simple guide or manual to the construction of modern electricity, telecommunication, city design, infrastructure to help the people in the Western Balkans to understand what a modern city-based economy looks like, so that they have actually got a picture in their minds what things should look like. When I was in Kosovo, I discovered little nastinesses, like they had a firewall, but they just put a billing system for the telecommunication system on the wrong side of the firewall. Somebody had sold them 132 fiber cables that covered all over the country, and I did a little calculation and discovered we can do perhaps two fibers instead of 132. So there's an awful lot of very useful practical help that might be put in, I wouldn't call it a manual, but I wonder if that might be a simple, straightforward step forward.
Well, I mean, I'm an optimist. I do look on this sort of scene, which is not unique at all to the West Balkans, as generational. I think there is an elder generation around in many countries who regards the pattern of corruption and capture to prescribe to be the norm, and that's the way it is, and they ought to get their due rewards, and the system works that way. I think that's a completely outdated view. What are my reasons for optimism that it is outdated? Well, I thought we've already got three. Youth. I'm not sure that the highly communicated and informed youth of today accepts that sort of old man and old woman's view, older generation's view. Gender equality. I think there's a tremendous... I was very impressed by the drive of the women's organisations, particularly my experience of them in Sarajevo, in really trying to cut through some of these customs, practices, unacceptable arrangements, captures and fixes which you encountered in trying to do your work technologically. And I suppose the same point again, the ubiquity of mobile connections and the wide open availability of the web system worldwide. I wasn't aware, we all know that the Chinese government has a long time trying to filter and curate access to the web. I wasn't aware, David may contradict me, that certainly in Bosnia and Herzegovina, or in Macedonia, or in Kosovo, there was any particular effort to do that. Not so sure about Belgrade. I don't think there was. And you know, the web and the digital age is a great equaliser and a great penetrator of old and nasty guilds and customs which keep out competition and undermine reform. So that's why I'm optimistic, but you may think it's too optimistic.
Thank you very much. Question down the aisle there, Jacqueline.
Good afternoon. My name is Howard Thompson. And from about 1996 to about 2003, I was very regularly involved in Bosnia and Kosovo because I handled the insurance for most of the mine clearance operations that were going on there, some of which were UN-supported, some of which were European and UK charities. During that time, I made a great many friends. I was able to deal with Serbs, Muslims, and Croats, and cross all the barriers. They all accepted me, and that was great. And getting to know the people, I learned a lot of their attitudes, and most of the people that I met were perhaps employed by the organisations for whom I was working as drivers or translators. They're extremely well-educated young people, and the only work at that time that they could get was the work that I'm describing, translators, drivers. You get to know them very, very well. And most of them were determined to move away. Several of them were Muslims, and the inevitable comment that they were all moving away from was the fact that Saudi Arabia was pumping mega millions in to their country with one intention only, to Turkey is doing exactly the same thing now. We therefore have the potential of fundamental Islam being bred in these countries, and not at the request of the existing Muslims who were perfectly moderate. What I'm wondering is, there doesn't appear to be a slight change in Saudi Arabia's attitude with the current Crown Prince. Your summit in July, will that be including any representation from Saudi Arabia? Could they perhaps now, if they really are following the indications that appear to be somewhat more relaxed in their attitudes, could they in fact be encouraged to be supportive?
Yes. Well, I think your analysis is very, very interesting, and one to which we were a bit exposed. It's perfectly true that, first of all, as I said earlier, there is a lot of heavy investment about Saudi Arabia, and also some interest of a more sinister kind of the jihadi movements in the region, who send a lot of people, as we do in this country, to, or have sent them to fight the jihadis. So the contrast between the gentle Islam, which has taken place on European soil the last few hundred years, some of it because people just converted to the Turkish version, Turkish religion, in order to survive and get on several hundred years ago. But there is a gentle Islam, and along comes suggestions of a more ferocious and dogmatic and even intolerant Islam. It's a very serious matter, and one that actually should occupy us here very clearly indeed, because this is our problem as well. So I agree with the analysis. As to, I can't answer your question as to whether there's been a Saudi invitation to the summit. I don't know whether anyone else knows here, but I just have no idea.
I think the answer is no.
The answer is no, is it? Well, that's perhaps it's an answer that should turn to yes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said for, even though we think some of the outside parties are not helpful, lots of if these sort of conferences are bringing in the outside parties. This is, you know, we are in a globalised, connected system, and it's the views of other people who are going to shape this area as much as anything we can do from here.
Jacqueline, I know we're almost out of time. Will you allow me to take just two more questions, very quick ones, Othon and then Jonathan?
Thank you very much. I'm Othon, Mr. Sankis from CISOX office here at Harvard at Oxford. And can I ask you specifically about the Berlin process? Because this is what the London summit is all about. Would you like to comment a little bit on what you consider to be the major achievements of the Berlin process, in which the London summit will be able to build on, and whether the emphasis on security diverts the aim of the Berlin process, which is about infrastructure, education, and investment. So is it something that you can comment on?
Jonathan, last question.
Jonathan Chen, also CSOX. You have talked about civil society and some of your recommendations about different areas of civil society. My own experience in the region suggests that very often civil society tends to be a bit an urban elitist type of operation. And I just wonder whether you've given any thought, or whether you've given any thought to ways of getting out to the rural population, who are typically conservative with a small C, and rather attracted to the commentator called elastic authoritarianism in the region.
Yeah, like, I mean, these inquiries are always undertaken in a fairly short time span by people who rely on our witnesses to bring evidence before us. And so, no, the short and honest answer to you is we did not look in that degree of granularity into what could be done. But I think what we were, in the recommendation we have made about the British government to using the opportunity of the Balkan summit to set out a proper resource and serious contribution, say, over the next 5 years, should, of course, their job to probe much more deeply into that. And on the Berlin process, well, I think the absolute bottom line is that it manages to avoid the Western Balkans being marginalised, as has risked happening in recent years, as we become preoccupied with much more immediate and in some cases much even more alarming crises like Syria or like North Korea or whatever it is. So I think it serves a very good purpose in that respect. But if that's the only thing it does, that's not a lot. And the great need, and which I hope the British government will feel impelled partly by the criticism that it doesn't seem to have a lot of content to its slogans, but I hope they will be goaded by that criticism into actually doing something at this summit. It's what the practical programs are that get endorsed there, and then of course the follow-up to them, because so often these wonderful communiques end up not producing as much as they appear to produce, or alternatively just committing money that's already been committed, and so on. So that's the key to it. The key to it is it provides a focus, and it's a focus that is all the more needed at a time when so many other issues are taking people's attention away from the Balkans, and as we said in our analysis in the past, that has been a recipe for disaster.
I just want to end on a cheerful note, on a note that I hope would cheer all diplomats, although concerned with our overseas policy, or ex-diplomats, or in the room. It's all going to take, this post-Brexit world we're moving into, and the sort of issues we're talking about, are all going to take a great deal more diplomacy, manpower and resources than we have at present. At the moment, the sort of soft spearhead of our power, hard, mixed, smart and sharp, whatever it is the Foreign Office. It's run on a shoestring, it's unproposed. The ambassadors are all run on a shoestring. Some of them are quite brilliant. We were enormously impressed by both Belgrade and Sarajevo. I was, because I visited those two areas. We're going to need a lot more of them. A lot more skill, a lot more engagement in the cultures and languages of 191 countries around the world. That's going to take a lot of manpower and woman power, and a lot of very, very determined overseas policy. Michael Clark of RUSI was putting this point before our committee the other day and saying in this new world we're moving into, almost aside from Brexit, because it's digitalized and everyone is, the new audiences you have to engage with at every point, highly informed audiences and new networks on every side, we are going to need a lot more involvement. And that means a lot more people involved in the operations of the diplomacy and interface of this country. So there's the cheerful thought, that'll make the Berlin process work, but lots of other processes we've got to make work as well, and a lot more effort's going to be required. So there we are, that's the future, and that's what some of us feel very strongly, the future we want to make. Thank you.